Hello and welcome to History Plus True Crime Uncovered, a podcast series that will explore all things history, including historical stories, people, and even places of interest. If you're into these topics, then I think you've found the right place. To start out, I have to give a disclaimer as many episodes are either graphic in nature or inappropriate for certain age groups. Some content in this episode may be sensitive to some listeners. Discretion is advised for those under the age of 13. I am your host, Jamie Peters. Let's dive in. This is part two of infamous kidnappings. These notorious abductions captured the attention of an entire nation in their era and continue to fascinate even decades later. Olive Oatman. Olive Oatman may have survived her kidnapping, but she was forever marked by it quite literally. In 1851, the 14-year-old was traveling through Arizona with her family in search of a place where they could settle down. As the Oatmans approached what is now Maricopa County, they were warned that forging ahead would not only mean difficult terrain, but likely a violent encounter with indigenous tribes. Undaunted, the family of nine continued on, but they didn't make it far before the ominous warning proved true. About 90 miles away from Yuma, the family encountered some Native Americans, possibly Yukawi. What exactly happened isn't clear, but six members of the family were killed. 15-year-old Lorenzo Oatman had been beaten and left for dead, while sisters Olive and Marianne were simply gone. Olive would later recount that for a year, the sisters were forced into hard labor for the tribe, all while being beaten and burned with sticks. Death seemed imminent until members of a different tribe, the Mojave, offered to trade for them. In exchange for a few horses, blankets, and vegetables, the Oatman sisters once again found their fates in the hand of strangers. But this time it worked in their favor. The girls were adopted by the Mojave tribal leaders and treated as their own, which included marking them with cactus ink tattoos on their chins and upper arms, a ritual meant to help them be recognized as Mojave in the afterlife. But by Olive's own accounts, her time with the Mojave was nothing short of idyllic. That changed when a drought caused a crop shortage and major famine in the Southwest. Mary Ann and many others members of the tribe starved to death. Olive survived thanks to her foster mother sneaking her rations. In 1855, the Mojave received a message from the federal government. They had heard that a young white woman was living with the tribe and demanded her return. If they refused, the government threatened the tribe would be destroyed. Olive's Mojave family was devastated, but eventually they reluctantly returned her to protect the rest of the tribe. Against her will, Olive was assimilated back into white society, but the Western dresses and fancy updos couldn't disguise the thick blue lines on her chin. After she married a wealthy rancher in 1865, Olive had turned to veils and heavy makeup to try to hide the tattoos. Cynthia Ann Parker. 15 years before the Oatman family's fateful encounter, Cynthia Ann Parker had a similar experience a couple of states over. In 1836, young Cynthia Ann, her brother, and several others were taken when Fort Parker, her family's residence in central Texas, was attacked by Comanche warriors. While the other captives were released, Cynthia remained with the tribe for the next 25 years, marrying and having two sons and a daughter. In 1860, Texas Rangers captured the three Native Americans and were shocked to find blue-eyed Cynthia Ann among them. Like Olive Oatman, Cynthia was forcibly taken from her Comanche family, leaving her young sons behind. It's said she tried to escape many times but was never successful. She died in 1870, allegedly from starving herself to death. One of her sons, Quanoia Parker, became a war chief and led his tribe in the battle against white expansion in Texas in the mid-1870s. When that failed, he tried to settle on a reservation in southwestern Oklahoma and became, according to Britannica, the principal chief of all Comanche, an honor that had never before been bestowed. He interrupted white civilization to the Comanche while advocating for his people. He even became friends with Theodore Roosevelt and attended his inauguration in 1905. He and his mother reinterred near his home in Oklahoma in 1910, but they were moved again in 1957 to Fort Sill National Cemetery, joining other Native American legends like Sitting Bear, Satana, and Kicking Bird. Nell Donnelly. There were thousands of kidnappings, including the abduction and murder of Charles Lindbergh's toddler son in 1932 during the economic hardship of the Great Depression. Among the victims was Kansas City, Missouri resident Nell Donnelly, one of the nation's preeminent fashion designers. Her label, Nellie Don, provided a little style and flair to thrifty Depression-era women. She employed over 1,000 people and grew Donnelly Garment Company into a $3.5 million business, unheard of for the time, and also the reason she attracted the attention of the wrong people. On December 16, 1931, Donnelly and her chauffeur were ambushed by armed men, who forced them out of the car and drove them to a safe house an hour away. They made Donnelly write a ransom note demanding $75,000, adding that if it wasn't received, the chauffeur would be killed and Donnelly would be blinded. Panicked, Donnelly's husband recruited their friend and neighbor James Reed, who happened to be a former U.S. senator with lots of helpful ties, including to organized crime. He contacted crime boss Johnny Lazia and threatened him. Either his syndicate could help find Donnelly or he would go after his enterprise with figurative guns ablazing. The threat worked. Lazia's men found the kidnappers and told them to abort the scheme immediately if they didn't want to run afoul of KC's biggest mob boss. Like magic, Donnelly and her chauffeur were both released on December 18th. All three kidnappers were positively identified, arrested, and jailed, but that's not where the story ends. A couple of years after her ordeal, Nell divorced her husband and married the man who had come to her rescue, James Reed. Maybe not so surprising, but decades later, the full story came out. Donnelly and Reed had been involved long before the kidnapping, even having a son, David, whom Donnelly and her first husband had claimed to have adopted. Mary McElroy. This abduction also takes us to Kansas City in the 1930s. Mary McElroy was enjoying a hot bath in her home on May 27, 1933, when she was rudely interrupted. Two men disguised as delivery drivers had gained entrance downstairs, overpowered the staff with their revolvers, and then went upstairs to urge Mary out of the tub. They allowed her to get dressed. She even had time to put on a pair of hose, and then they took her to a house about 10 miles away in Shawnee, Kansas, where they chained her to a wall in a basement. The kidnappers demanded $60,000 from Mary's father, Henry McElroy, the city manager of Kansas City, who had close ties to corrupt KC political boss Thomas Pendergrass. After negotiating down to $30,000, Henry handed over the cash, and Mary was released a day later, with cab fare no less. Four men were arrested not long after. One of them was eventually sentenced to death. Mary, however, had grown sympathetic to her kidnappers, maintaining that they had been perfectly polite while holding her hostage, even giving her flowers before releasing her. She was so distraught at the death sentence that she recruited her father to help obtain a stay of execution. Mary continued to visit her captors in jail for the rest of her life, but unfortunately, that wasn't long. On January 20th, 1940, she died by suicide. Mary left a note that said that the men who kidnapped her are probably the only people on earth who don't consider me an utter fool. You have your death penalty now, so please give them a chance. Adolph Coors III. An empty car idling with the doors open and the radio on is really a good sign. That's the scene a milk delivery man came across in Morrison, Colorado, when he headed out to make his daily rounds on February 9, 1960. Closer inspection revealed a hat on the riverbank and a reddish brown stain spattered on the bridge railing. The next day, Mary Coors received a typewritten ransom note requesting $500,000 for the return of her husband, heir to the Coors Brewing Company fortune and grandson of its founder. Authorities quickly focused on a distinctive car that had been spotted in the area around the same time as the kidnapping, a bright yellow 1951 Ford Mercury. The car was eventually linked to an escaped murderer named Joseph Corbett Jr. 7 months Coors' disappearance, hikers near Sedalia, Colorado, discovered a pair of pants and a keyring engraved with AC3. Skeletal remains were scattered in the forest nearby. The search for Adolf Coors was over. It was determined that he had been shot in the back. The search for his killer continued for about another 2 months, but on October 29th, Corbett was finally arrested. His undoing? A figure engine red Pontiac. After his wanted photo appeared in Reader's Digest, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police received several tips from people who had spotted Corbett always driving the flashy car. He was finally captured when the car was seen in a motel parking lot in Vancouver. Corbett was convicted and sent to prison. The Ariel Castro Kidnappings. The horrifying crimes of Ariel Castro rocked Cleveland, Ohio, and the rest of America when they came to light. Castro had orchestrated the kidnappings of Michelle Knight, Amanda Berry, and Georgiana DeJesus between 2002 and 2004. For about a decade, the three ladies remained locked up in Castro's home, where they lived under terrible conditions. In that time, the case became national news, even getting featured on America's Most Wanted. It remained unsolved until 2013, when Berry escaped from the house with her daughter and was able to lead police back there. Castro was arrested and sentenced to life imprisonment, but he took his own life 1 month later. Bobby Dunbar. Born to Leslie and Percy Dunbar, Bobby Dunbar was a four-year-old boy who went missing in 1912 while on a Louisiana fishing trip with his family. For 8 months, police searched all over the country, and the case attracted significant media attention. It all took a bizarre turn when it was reported that Dunbar had been found with a man named William Walters in Mississippi. But according to Walters, the boy with him was actually Bruce Anderson, the son of Julia Anderson, a field hand of the Walters family. Notwithstanding, a court ruled that the boy belonged to the Dunbars, and Walters was later sent to prison for kidnapping him. Decades later, DNA testing proved that the boy was in fact not Bobby Dunbar. Elizabeth Smart. On June 5, 2002, a young Elizabeth Smart was kidnapped from her home in the middle of the night by Brian David Mitchell. Mitchell took Smart to a camp in the woods where he and his wife, Wanda Barzi, kept her in prison for 9 months. Smart's name and face were plastered all over the news, and at one time, about 2,000 volunteers searched for her every day. After a drawing of Mitchell appeared on TV, he was eventually spotted and reported to police. Smart was rescued and reunited with her family on March 12, 2003. Since then, she has played an instrumental role in the passing of legislation to promote child safety. And there are so many more lists of abductions. I might even do a part three on this. But there's just so many. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe and leave a rating and review. And as always, leave comments or send an email to historytruecrimeuncovered@gmail.com with suggestions for future episodes. Until then, catch you next time.